The last sentence of what Richie talked about last week was so important. With the middle of page 127, it says, although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found that we could not place money first. For us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded. And I shared with the group last week that that had been my experience as well. I have my own company. It's a consulting company. And, it's really interesting because I wasn't trained in what I do. I learned about it through other people and through studying and reading about it and practicing it. But when you have your own business and you're not getting a paycheck every single week, it's not like, okay, today's payday. And so that can be really unsettling, and it creates a lot of worry and stress. Now, what happened was the idea that I started to understand the work that I do, which is social and emotional intelligence and mental health and wellness, and helping educators to build relationships with each other and with their students to have a better understanding of who their students are and what's important to them emotionally, and help them, kind of think their way out of a problem or solve problems or self-advocate. But I was so sure that God had given me this knowledge and had given me these experiences and put me in the right place at the right time to have these experiences. I was so convinced of that. And what I would do is during my meditation, I would walk in the park every day, and it would just start flowing, like these ideas and how I needed to do it and what I was going to do and what that would look like and what my daily task would be was just coming to my mind. And I'd furiously be writing it down in my notes. I'd furiously, as I was exercising. And so there was no doubt to me that that had come from God. And, I got divorced first and then got sober. And so, who knows, if I had actually gotten sober before that, maybe my life would be completely different right now. But that's just the way it went. So I was alone with three children, and I needed to be there for their physical and emotional needs, and also have a job and also take care of the house and cook meals and laundry and all the other things I was still doing. So very early on, I realized that I was going to have to put God first before I put money. It just didn't work that way. And I had to believe. I was almost like forced into this trusting God, that God was going to provide for me financially. I was forced. I had no other, because my kids had to come first. I am very, very needy. I had one child, very, very emotionally needy. And, I've never missed a mortgage payment. And I still have a car. And as long as I wasn't drinking and I was following God's, what I thought God wanted me to do, and serving anyone he put in front of me. So that has been my experience. That the money just came. And really random things happen. Someone would knock on my door and say, "Hi, I was wondering if we could use your house for a movie set." Or I've had commercials filmed at my house. I've had reality shows. Just random things happen to me. I put my house on Airbnb, and within 24 hours had like 14 weekends booked. I mean, that's a whole nother thing, so I have to move out every weekend. the bottom line was, he gave me these ideas. God gave me the ideas and the resources, and he put the people in my life so that I could be okay financially and put my children and their needs, first, and put AA and put serving God. He's put a lot of people in my life that need people to help them. So, just going on from them and that in the middle of page 127, since the home has suffered more than anything else, it is well that a man exert himself there. He is not likely to get far in any direction if he fails to show unselfishness and love under his own roof. We know there are difficult wives and families, but the man who is getting over alcoholism must remember he did much to make them so. You know, it's like the idea is the alcoholic creates the chaos. Or the fear in his children, or the uncertainty with his wife, or the distrust. I mean, that alcoholic created all of that. So in order to serve, I mean, the first place that we all need to serve are the people that we're with every day, that we see. And you just can't say, oh, okay, I got sober, and everything's going to be okay. It's like that chapter about coming out of the basement after the tornado. You know, the first place that we have to serve unconditionally is with our loved ones, with our families, and the people that we live with. As each member of a resentful family begins to see his shortcomings and admits them to others, he lays a basis for helpful discussion. These family talks will be constructive if they can be carried on without heated argument, self-pity, self-justification, or resentful criticism. Little by little, mother and children will see they ask too much, and father will see he gives too little. Right? So it's really hard to have those conversations. I mean, they taught us in step four how to have those conversations about starting the conversation by admitting our faults and then saying, you know, what would you like to tell me about that? And if you're practicing those spiritual principles with your family, those relationships will get better as well. It's probably not going to get better if you don't follow the instructions in this book, or you're not going to stay sober if you don't follow the instructions in this book. And, you know, it was funny because I asked somebody if they had a certain experience and they said, oh, you know, I really never drank around my family, so I didn't really have any stories about the family afterwards. But, you know, the thing is that whether we realize it or not, everything that we do affects everybody else around us. And so just because you don't think you drank around them or you didn't come in before, I mean, the bottom line is the way we thought, the way we acted, the decisions that we made affected everyone in our lives. Many of you know I'm the oldest of seven kids. And, you know, I've been sober almost 11 years, but those siblings and their spouses definitely have an idea. I mean, I think a lot of the times they forget that I'm the new Jill, and they automatically react, you know, to the old Jill. Maybe my intentions. I mean, you know, okay, so I'm a little bit bossy. Well, that was my job, you know. I mean, I was supposed to protect them, and that doesn't go away just because they grow up, you know. And you know, I want to help them and make their lives better. And I did have three children. And, you know, I think sometimes maybe I give advice when it's not wanted or it's not asked for, and I have to be super, super cognizant of how people react to me, especially my in-laws, you know, the sister-in-laws and brother-in-laws, because I'm not their family, and they don't really want advice. In their mind, I was... You know, it's so different. Like, when growing up together, you know what the other, you know what your siblings think. You know, you all had the same mom, the same dad. You had the same routines. You had the same practices. Like, I don't know. I think maybe a lot of times, at least your family understands, you know, where you're coming from, because you all had the same experiences. But it's no excuse for all the bad crap that you did and the way you made them feel. And, you know, they don't have a program. The family doesn't have a program, most of them. So they're going to hold on to resentments. They're going to remember what you did. And You know, it's like I used to say to my kids, when you were, someone didn't like you at school or you had a fight with somebody and you wanted to just, you didn't want to be friends, but you just, you have to kill them with kindness, or someone's mean to you, or you have to kill them with kindness. That is the only way to get through a relationship that's not good or positive or nice. That's all you can do. But that's actually a way to live. That's one of our spiritual practices. And it does work. It does change hearts. It does soften hardened hearts. Though the family does not fully agree with Dad's spiritual activities, they should let him have his head. Even if he displays a certain amount of neglect and irresponsibility toward the family, it is well to let him go as far as he likes in helping other alcoholics. Now, I imagine that if, you know, we're talking to someone's family and we're helping to explain that in order to stay sober, we have to rely on our higher power, and our higher power is asking us to help other alcoholics and give them what was so freely given to us, and that is one of the most important aspects of staying sober. I mean, it is one of the key components is helping other alcoholics. But this is going to be really hard, especially to your family who felt neglected, whether you were out drinking or out working and focusing on, you know, money, or whether you were just not emotionally present. And that's going to be really, really hard. But there has to be communication and explaining that that in order to get sober, we have to be able to follow these principles. We have to be able to do this. And we can't do that if the family's not working with us. During those first days of convalescence, this will do more to ensure his sobriety than anything else. Though some of his manifestations are alarming and disagreeable, we think Dad will be on a firmer foundation than the man who is placing business or professional success ahead of spiritual development. And, you know, the thing is, we need that rearrangement of our psyche, right? I mean, that's how we get sober. That's how we stay sober, rearrangement. If the alcoholic, I mean, they're calling him Dad here, but I'm going to replace my name, Mom, right? So if I had just said, okay, well, then this isn't working, and what I need to do is just go back to work and make more money. I mean, the bottom line was, that's not following the spiritual principles. Doing what I always did isn't following the spiritual principles. I mean, I had to have a rearrangement of my priorities. And those priorities had to be the people that God put in my care. He put three children in my care. And those had to be my priorities. And it, for me, when I, again, this is just another way, when I put the spiritual development and I put that work that I thought God wanted me to do with other people's children in schools, so that I could be present for my kids. I could be present when they woke up. I could be present when they were nervous about going to school or nervous about a test. I could be there when they got out of school, and I could be there to help them with their homework and take them to their activities and to put them to bed. When I put that spiritual piece and I took care of what God gave me first, the financial piece came. I mean, I think one of the things is that you have to be open to ideas. It may not be the job. I mean, I have to say, none of the jobs that I've done, I think would what I would have ever imagined doing when I was in college, getting a business degree. I mean, it just wasn't. These are because I think I said yes and I was open to people. The last two little gigs that I have, I had no people called me and they said, "Well, I heard this. And I was wondering if you might be interested." And I was like, not really, but what's your idea? You know, and then again, it's kind of like, I mean, I have somebody who doesn't know me, who I don't know, and somebody gave them my name. It's possible that God's got something going on here, you know, and, And I just got to be open to it. And again, just practicing that, and that's what I've been doing. I'm still putting my family, my youngest guy, still in high school, because of COVID, coming home for lunch every day, having lunch with his mom every day. And again, I wouldn't be able to do that if I wasn't putting what I thought God wanted me to do first. He will be less likely to drink again, and anything is preferable to that. And, you know, the bottom line was, I don't know about you all, but when I was drinking, everything else came second. I mean, my relationship with my mother, my presence for my kids was not as important. My drinking and how I felt after a night of drinking and how I, you know, was planning how I was going to get out that night and who I was going to go with and what time I was going to get everyone to bed and what I was going to drink, that all those things were in the way of being emotionally present, again, to the children that God gave to me in my care. And so I had to give that up. Those two, I couldn't do both of those things. Both of those things couldn't be the most important thing. Those of us who spent much time in the world of spiritual make-believe have eventually seen the childness of it. This dream world has been replaced by a great sense of purpose, accompanied by a growing consciousness of the power of God in our lives. We have come to believe He would like us to keep our heads in the clouds with Him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. Right? So, I mean, that's like having God consciousness, like always being, you know, physically present with God, emotionally and consciously, and you know, but having our feet on the ground doing His work for Him and doing not for us but for Him with His people. And I think that that's just kind of just another way of saying what we already know from working these steps. This is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. And again, I guess, you know, it'd be interesting if your head was in the clouds, like he talks about this, like, spiritual make-believe, you know, like, you think you're doing good and you're, you know, talking the talk, but if your feet, if you're not doing the work, you know, the actual worker bee work, the spirituality piece isn't going to work. It's not going to change you. It's not going to work. We have to put principles with practice. In my work, I call it experiential learning. You know, it's like, you can't just read. When I do trainings, I don't just talk about it. We actually have to practice it. And we're going to stop, we get into small groups, and then we practice it. And then I say, now tomorrow I want you to go with your students, and I want you to practice it. You know, we're not going to just sit here and talk about it and ask you guys to take notes. That's not how you make a change. And I think, in reality, almost everything that I do at work came, those practices and learning how to teach something and how to change somebody came from these steps. And I just easily put them into my work world. I just followed these exact instructions, and I just made it work in that way. There are realities for us. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. Let's read that again. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. One more suggestion. Whether the family has spiritual convictions or not, they may do well to examine the principles by which the alcoholic member is trying to live. So, right, the families might as well look into it and see if they can get on board with these principles. And, you know, from my own family, because my family afterwards, it's either I can tell you about how these principles work with my children, I can tell you about how they work with my siblings, I can tell you how they work with my parents. And, you know, as far as my children, I have to be the example. I mean, you can't tell a kid what to do. I mean, the only way a kid will do what you want them to do, certainly older children, teenagers, and young adults, if they do what you do. They don't do what you say, they do what you do. And so, in other words, I have to be that example if I expect them to follow along, you know, to hop on board. And I, again, I use a practice that we learn here in that book is I tell stories. And I try not to tell them what to do and how to do it, but I just might use a story to tell them or use a personal experience. That's what the Bible does too. You know, that's what they, it's a story. All it is a book of stories. That's it, you know? You know, I think also my siblings, the same thing. I mean, actually, I had a bridal shower yesterday for my youngest brother is getting married, and he's 17 years younger than me. And, you know, I said I told her I wanted to have the shower for you. I wanted to invite all your friends and your family and, you know, put on this big party for you and make it all about you. And I invited a woman from the community who I met here at church, and I'd been helping her for, I don't know, probably about 7 or 8 years. She has cerebral palsy, and I drive her to her therapy, and I befriended her, and I cook for her, and all sorts of things. You know, do her technical stuff. My kids do everything for her, you know. And so I told her that she, on these trips back and forth, when we drive to Kessler on Mondays and Fridays, I've been talking about the plans for the party and, you know, the menu and the theme and all the, like, little things I had to do to put it together. And I, you know, so I invited her to come. And she needs a ramp. She doesn't really do stairs or anything like that. She's got this huge walker. I don't know, she's got cerebral palsy, so the right side of her body doesn't work, really. I mean, so badly her brain's trying to tell this side to move, and it's just very, very hard. So anyways, I invited her, and so my daughter went and got her. No questions asked, was happy and delighted to go get her, and we got her into the house. There was a couple stairs. I mean, everybody just jumped in, was helping her, and, you know, we got her right in the middle of the party, and, you know, everyone fed her, and we were playing games, and, you know, she didn't really know anybody because it wasn't her friends or family, but whatever, she was a part of it, and her family doesn't really include her in anything that they do. So after last night, my sister Betsy said to me, you know, I just want to tell you something. You know, I watched what you did with Sally. I watched how you made her feel. I watched the way you spoke to her. I watched the way you included her. I watched. And she's like, you know, I've never really seen you with her, and I know that you've been doing this for her for years. And it was just really beautiful. It was just really neat to watch Jill. And again, that's me putting my feet on the ground with my head in the clouds. I don't make any other plans on Mondays and Fridays from 3 to 6. That's what I do. I don't do anything else. That's another reason I can't take a different kind of job. I have to work around her. But that was this example, really, of what happened with my family, this family who saw the difference in me. I couldn't tell them about that. And a lot of the times I think they think of me as the bossy one, or you know what I mean? I'm always telling them what to do with their little... I'm not trying to. I think it just comes very natural. I mean, I have 3 kids. Like, if your kid is doing something, I might say, oh, you know, one thing that might work, or, you know, I mean, I just try to give suggestions, and it doesn't cross my mind that they don't want those suggestions, because I always think, why wouldn't you want something that works? Like, why would you want to have a screaming kid who's doing this when I can tell you some really good strategies? Plus, I do this for work, too. You know, I'm not trying to, but anyways, those were examples of that example of her watching and being witness to that and then telling me that. It's just an example of how this works. You know, and I've had with my family, it's been hard. I think so, two families, two of my siblings and their spouses moved here during COVID. I thought this was going to be the best. I'm going to be hanging out with my sibling, my sister, my brothers all the time. We're going to be hanging out and doing stuff and riding bikes and doing sports. And what's happened is nobody really includes me in anything. They just do their own thing. And they hang out together because they have the same. And they all are big drinkers. And it really is hurtful. It really hurts my feelings. And you know, sometimes I've tried to say something, and then, like, my brother will get back, well, you're just so bossy that my wife just gets annoyed because you're always telling her what to do. And I'm like, No, I'm not. I mean, meanwhile, whatever. They're complaining that they have three kids under four and they need help. And then somehow I guess I'm doing something wrong. But the bottom line is, I think as the more I get in the book with those relations with my family, and I try to come here on Sundays and I think about what that means with my relationship, not with just my brother, but with my brother's wife. Right? And I mean, again, his kids are like, I feel like they're my own children. I love them just like I love my own. But there's that other dynamic in there of somebody that's not related to me and that doesn't have to love me. But I'm working really hard on those relationships. But I don't know. I think you can't work on something if you first haven't admitted that you're not doing a great job at it. You're not doing something right. And that's me, again, the family afterwards, living the steps in my family's experiences. You know, some of these in-laws, they never saw me drink, you know, because I've been sober longer than they've been married to my siblings. But I still have the same attitude. You know, I still do the same things. I still act the same way in a lot of ways. I mean, still working on this psychic change of mine. Okay, so they can hardly fail to approve these simple principles, though the head of the house still fails somewhat in practicing them. Of course, we always go back to what we always do. You know, at least for me, I have to really practice and keep connected with God, keep my head in the clouds, and keep conscious contact. Because I will fail. Nothing will help the man who is off on a spiritual tangent so much as the wife who adopts a sane spiritual program, making a better practical use of it. I can't talk to that. There will be other profound changes in the household. Liquor incapacitated father for so many years that mother became head of the house. She met these responsibilities gallantly. By force. So I'm just thinking, you know, what if you were incapacitated and you were drinking, who in your life took over your responsibilities, the things that you were supposed to be in charge of, the things that you were supposed to be thinking of? Was it the finances? Was it your family? Was it the house? Was it the yard? I mean, by force of circumstances, she was often obligated to treat father as a sick or wayward child. Because honestly, that's what drinking is. Drinking, I mean, you can't rely on somebody who's drinking. You can't give them responsibilities. So yeah, it is, I think, for a spouse, really becomes, you become the other child. And that sets up for a major resentful life. You know, you're not the person I thought you were. You're not the partner I thought you were going to be. You know, I tell you how I feel and you don't change. So that's a big, big responsibility for that spouse and that family. Even when he wanted to assert himself, he could not, for his drinking placed him constantly in the wrong. Mother made all the plans and gave the directions. When sober, father usually obeyed. Thus, mother, though no fault of her own, became accustomed to wearing the family trousers. Father, coming suddenly to life again, often begins to assert himself. This means trouble, unless the family watches for these tendencies in each other and comes to a friendly agreement about them. Drinking isolates most homes from the outside world. Because what? We're embarrassed. I mean, we're embarrassed of what happens. There was a 40th birthday party last night, and so this was after this beautiful shower that I had. There was still one more huge event. And you know, included with, like, everyone dressed up, there was a surprise, then we got on a party bus, then we all got dropped off at Topgolf in Edison, where more people were dressed up, and music, and alcohol everywhere, and, you know, food, and but again, I was telling two of these guys, you know, what would happen when is I would isolate, and I love, so I mean, I get my energy from being out and being social, but at the end of my drinking, I would start slurring my when I would have drinks, maybe after two or three drinks, I would start slurring my words, and I was very conscious of not letting people see that, you know, because that wouldn't make me be the respected mother and woman and community member, the church lady that I was. So I started the isolating, you know, and so we're used to kind of covering for our family and like, no, let's just stay home and, you know, and so, you know, we do become, I think most of us have that experience, we become isolated. Father may have laid aside for years all normal activities, clubs, civic duties, sports. When he renews interest in such things, a feeling of jealousy may arise. The family may feel they hold a mortgage on Dad, so big that no equity should be left for outsiders. I mean, they were deprived of their parent for all those years. Like, when that parent gets better, they better, you know, the family feels you better make it up to us. Like, we deserve your love and full attention and your full energy. I mean, obviously, if this alcoholic is following the steps, they are trying to rejoin life. They're trying to, you know, be a part of the outside world and be an example. So instead of developing new channels of activity for themselves, mother and children demand that he stay home and make up the deficiency. Uh-oh, right? So now you have your family working against you. I mean, you can totally see. Does anybody have an experience like that? Where all of a sudden they're like, oh, no. Yeah. At the very beginning, the couple ought to frankly face the fact that each will have to yield here and there if the family is going to play an effective part in the new life. The father will necessarily spend much time with other alcoholics, but this activity should be balanced. New acquaintances who know nothing of alcoholism may be made in thoughtful consideration given their needs. The problems of the community might engage attention. Though the family has no religious connections, they may wish to make contact with or take membership in a religious body. I mean, I don't know about you all, but I went to church my whole life, and I got what I got out of it. And, you know, mostly I loved the people. I loved the socialness of it. I loved the familiarity of it. Felt very safe. I it was the same prayers every week. It was the same words every week, and it felt very comfortable. But it wasn't until I came into AA where I started to get a deep, deep understanding of what my purpose and of following what God wanted me to do and putting my spirituality and learning a whole different way. I have to say, the church and being a part of that community is also strengthens my spirituality that I learned through AA. Because I do now have a different way of thinking. I have a different way of living my life. But that's just like icing. Like, going to church for me is icing. Like, the music, I mean, we have this contemporary service, the harmony, I mean, the guitars, the acoustic, I mean, it is just really, really, for me, very earth-shattering. It's very moving. Music evokes emotion, right? So I'm very emotional during the music, and it really helps me get connected to God and to think about my purpose and who I'm going to serve and how I'm going to do it. I mean, it brings me to tears. Like, that's how deeply emotional I feel. And the other interesting thing is, you know, when you are in a church community or religious community, like they're suggesting, you're around other people who want to do good. That doesn't mean everyone there is perfect, right? And sometimes, you know, it's a time where you get into a community where you have a lot of different personalities. So it's a great place to work on. At least for me, it's a lot of different personalities, and they may not do things the way I want, and the service may not be run the way it always was, and I may not like this spiritual leader or this pastor, or I think, you know, this person shouldn't be doing this. Or, oh, one thing is, it's so cold there. Like, the men go and they like put down the thing, and I'm in there freezing, and my nose is cold. I look around, everyone's got coats, I'm always like ticked off, you know. But it's good practice for me to be in a spot where I'm not getting everything that I want exactly the way I want it. Like, you know, but boy, for me, I'm just saying that this, between the two of them together, it really, really is created this really deep spirituality that I have, and the ability to practice it. Alcoholics who have derided religious people will be helpful by such contacts. Being possessed of a spiritual experience, the alcoholic will find he has much in common with these people, though he may differ with them on many matters. If he does not argue about religion, he will make new friends and is sure to find new avenues of usefulness and pleasure. You know, that's, again, like, I think the neat thing is, for me at our church, there's a lot of opportunity to serve others. There's a lot of opportunity to put other people first, or other ideas first, and put yourself last. And it's just nice because you don't have to do all the work yourself. You can go and just sign up and just, you know, put your name on the list. And it gives you that ability to practice. Again, practice makes perfect, right, you guys? I mean, you cannot just sit home and do the same thing you've always done and be sober and expect to, like, be spiritual. I mean, you have to go practice it in real life with real people. He and his family can be a bright spot in such congregations. He may bring new hope and new courage to many a priest, minister, or rabbi who gives his all to minister to our troubled worlds. You know, I always say to the minister, the pastor, because I have my phone out taking notes, and I always say, just want to let you know I'm taking notes. I'm not texting while you're preaching, you know. But I would imagine for a minister, like someone who's that into what they say, like, I'm like taking notes so that I can do this exactly what you're telling me to do this week. I imagine that that must be pretty exciting, because, you know, as a speaker, you're hoping people are going to really take what you say and follow it. We intend the foregoing as a helpful suggestion only. So far as we are concerned, there's nothing obligatory about it. As non-denominational people, we cannot make up others' minds for them. Each individual shall consult his own conscience, right? So we're not telling you what to do. We're just laying out some ideas that other people have done that may help you deepen your spirituality. We have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nations, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. When we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. For his sake, we do not recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. But those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others find we are soon overcome by them. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience of our past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered, and we have been given the power to help others. I just think maybe I'll ask, does anybody have experiences of, like, having fun or coming into AA and being surprised that everybody was laughing or, yeah, right? And just, I don't know if everyone's been on retreats or anything, and people just, all sorts of fun, and you're like, boy, like, this is like a fun group of people, you know? I always say, like, look, my people, the people that I like are like rule breakers. You know, that's why I like you guys a lot, because you guys are like me. You know, you're willing to do funny and fun things, and you're willing to just goof on yourselves. And I mean, we do laugh at other people's stories because it's not horrifying to us, because we were there and we know how sick it was. But nowhere else is anyone going to laugh like that about these disgusting things that we did, you know? Everyone knows that those in bad health and those who seldom play do not laugh much, right? There's definitely a group of people that never laugh, that don't have fun. You know, they're just way serious. So let each family play together or separately as much as their circumstances warrant. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a vale of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it, right? God is love. God is joy. God is, and I know, I hear people talk about, you know, negative and being punished and going to hell and things like that. I asked my spiritual leader once why I've never heard the word hell in this building. And the explanation I got was that something, the idea of hell is what people put them, it's their own people put themselves through their own hell. Like that there's not really a hell that people go to. I mean, God is good. God is love, you know, and that he wants the very best. I mean, we're forgiven no matter what, whatever we do. And so that hell that you hear people talk about is the hell that we put ourselves through, that we put ourselves in, the agony, the guilt, all that stuff. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a vale of tears, though it once was just for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own, misery. God didn't do it. Okay, sorry, I already said that. Avoid them, the deliberate manufacturer of misery. But if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. Now about health. A body badly burned by alcohol does not recover overnight, nor do twisted thinking and depression vanish in a twinkling. We are convinced that a spiritual mode of living is a powerful health restorative. We, who have recovered from serious drinking, are miracles of mental health. But we have seen remarkable transformations in our bodies. Hardly one in our crowd now shows any mark of dissipation. I do know, at least I was, so when I quit drinking, I mean, I don't know specifically if there were some health issues, but I used drinking to not eat, you know, to be skinny. And so, you know, I was underweight, I would say, right? I also was smoking because, you know, once I started drinking, I didn't care what was good for me or what wasn't. I mean, I didn't care. And I knew that I would never be able to quit smoking if I was still drinking, because I didn't care if I hurt who I hurt. I mean, I used to actually say I'd rather die skinny. Who would say that? Like to the who has children? Who would say I'd rather die skinny? I mean, what a selfish thing to say, and what a vain thing to say, right? But I do know that I think after 10 years, your body regenerates itself. So if you once you've stop smoking or you know, your body. And so I was, because of drinking, able to stop smoking. So I was able to learn how to keep my weight down in a healthy way, not by trying to cheat the system of eating fat-free this or diet that, or, you know, I've worked really hard at my health. And I've been open to what other people have said and followed it. Now, I mean, I'll give you an example. I think about this all the time. I go to the doctor, and I don't know if you guys have ever, like, I had to have a health insurance change, so I had to get all, like, I couldn't, now I can't see the doctor I've been going to since I was 13 years old. So I go to this guy, and he wants to know. He's like, so, do you want to talk about your weight? I go, nope. He's like, well, do you want to get on the scale? I go, nope. And he's like, why not? You know, I've been doing Weight Watchers my whole life. This is why I say to him, like, I'm already telling him I know everything there is to know, and there's nothing you can tell me that I don't know, right? Oh, I'm fine. I walk, you know, I walk 4 miles every day, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, well, do you get your heart rate up? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you know, like, do you run? I was like, no, I don't run. And he's like, you know, do you get, like, heavy breathing? And I was like, no. And he's like, and I'm like, I can't believe I just admitted to this guy that I'm not perfect, that I'm not doing, even though I can brag about how much I walk, I really don't get my heart going. So he says to me, well, could you, like, run for, like, a block and just, like, get heavy breathing for a block? you know, and then walk for the next four blocks. And I was like, yeah, I could do that, you know. And all of a sudden, I'm just becoming more open to somebody else, again, not thinking I know everything. Like, I'm saying, like, okay, just because you're doing it, like, you're wrong, Jill. You're wrong. You have to, like, listen. You have to practice these principles. So I laugh all the time, and I, like, can't wait to get back to tell him, like, oh, I've been running a block at a time. Like, and I will do it. Like, it feels kind of silly and funny because I'm not really a runner. And then all of a sudden, I just break into a run. But I have been really trying to do that because he told me that that was important for my health. Hardly one of our crowd now shows any mark of dissipation. But this does not mean that we disregard human health measures. God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. There you go. Right? We are not supposed to know everything. He gave different people different skills to study different things. And if we do not listen, or we do not think we need, oh, I love this, like, oh, I don't take medicine. Like, yeah, but God gave people these, like, incredible brains to, like, come up with these medicines that help us. Like, don't try to suffer. There's no reason to suffer. There's no reason to it. God created humans that created things that can really help us. And that's really important because anytime you're not feeling good, you're not acting, you know, the people in your family or the people surrounding you are suffering. And they don't have to suffer if you have an ego small enough to take advice. Or to do what is recommended by professionals, like he says, fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. Most of them give freely of themselves, that their fellows may enjoy sound minds and bodies. Try to remember that through God, though God has wrought miracles among us, we should never belittle a good doctor or psychiatrist. Their services are often indispensable in treating a newcomer and in following his case afterward. I mean, we hear that all the time. Like, oh, you know, you just need to do the steps. You don't need to go to a psychologist. You know, you don't need to go to a doctor. So, and they're saying that's, you know, we should never belittle somebody that has that kind of knowledge because we never know what kind of help in what way and how somebody communicates something to someone. One of the many doctors who had the opportunity of reading this book in manuscript form told us that the use of sweets was often helpful, of course, depending upon a doctor's advice. He thought all alcoholics should constantly have chocolate available for its quick energy value at times of fatigue. He added that occasionally in the night a vague craving arose which would be satisfied by candy. Many of us have noticed a tendency to eat sweets and have found this practice beneficial. A word about sex relationships. Alcohol is so sexually stimulating to some men that they have overindulged. Couples are occasionally dismayed to find that when drinking is stopped, the man tends to be impotent. Unless the reason is understood, there may be an emotional upset. Some of us had this experience only to enjoy in a few months a finer intimacy than ever. Oh, well, I'll share something personally. I don't know if, you know, if I had ever had sex sober before I got sober. And so that was like a whole new thing. And, you know, yeah, being sober is really awesome in all areas, in all ways. You know, it's really, you know, it's a deep connection. The alcohol just, maybe it fueled some excitement, but it definitely blocked intimacy and it blocked pleasure, at least in my experience. Okay, the alcoholic may find it hard to reestablish friendly relations with his children. Their young minds were impressionable while he was drinking. Without saying so, they may cordially hate him for what he has done to them and to their mother. The children are sometimes dominated by a pathetic hardness and cynicism. They cannot seem to forgive and forget. They hang on for months, long after their mother has accepted dad's new way of living and thinking. You know, I know that if you brought my kids in here, especially my daughter, she would tell you all these things that I did that really hurt her. And, you know, I think maybe I didn't think it was like hurting them directly, but what I was doing to their father really hurt them. The way I spoke to him, the way I talked about him, that really hurt my children. And so, you know, it's funny how we think we're good. You know, we didn't, you know, that wasn't a problem. I mean, the other thing I would say is I got off, I have a very, very low bottom, my drinking. And so I would be one to say, like, well, I probably, you know, they didn't really see me drink until they saw me drink. Until that lasts like 6 months, you know? And here's the thing. We never know the impression that we have on somebody else. We don't know unless they tell us, right? And last night, my sisters and I were talking about things that parents have said to children that stuck with them their whole lives. That they, like something that they said that they never got over. And my next sister has like kind of a big butt, like a big bubble butt. And my mom, I guess, said it was like, told her that it was like two bowling balls with a blanket over it. And she's like, Mom said that to me. Like you know how long I've carried that? Like, that's what I think about when I look in the mirror. I said, oh, well, you want to know what she said to me? And I said, I used to have a bigger nose. I had a nose job when I was 33 because I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. I said, yeah, Mom said to me, well, yeah, you have a man's nose on a woman's body. Like, you know, and so my point is, I'm not saying my mom's a bad person. And honestly, moms just say shit. I mean, I do it. I'm a mom. Like, I know. I don't think about everything. I don't have time to think about every consequence that will come out of something that I say. You know, and sometimes, I mean, I have a daughter who literally talks nonstop. She's 22 years old, and she literally tells you every single thought that she has. And sometimes I'm just like, shut up! Like, or sometimes I just say something to shut her up. Like, I don't care! Like, you know, it's like, it's really hard. It's really hard being like someone's... It's really hard having someone depend on you so much. It's so hard. It's draining. So anyways, I mean, believe me, you know, I'm sure that she always tells me that I screwed her up. And I mean, luckily because I have a program, I think I'm a little bit more sensitive to it. But like she's, you know, of course, as a child, you want what you want. Like, you want your mother to treat you a certain way and to be there the way you want them to be, and you can't control the way other people are, you know? She was getting together with this old boyfriend last night. I'm like, oh, please tell me that you're not getting together with him. Please. I'm like, and she goes, you're just supposed to be supportive of me. I said, no, I'm not. And she said, when she left, apparently he was picking her up after a night out, and her four aunts chased her out the door. I wasn't there. Her four aunts chased her out the door because they didn't want her to go with him. But, you know, again, it's my life, she says to me. I'm like, yeah, but you also complained to everybody who would listen for the last 6 months about, you know. But, you know, again, the bottom line is don't be fooled and think that you've never hurt somebody by what you've said or how you've acted towards them. That would be very selfish for us to think that. And just in the program and practicing it and showing up and going to meetings and helping other alcoholics and doing steps with other people just reminds you of things that happen in life. And just for me is a check on me. If I'm thinking about it, at least I'm going to be a little bit better than if I'm not thinking about it, you know. In time, they will see that he is a new man, and in their own way, they will let him know it. When this happens, they will be invited to join in morning meditation, and then they can take part in a daily discussion without rancor or bias. From that point on, progress will be rapid. Marvelous results often follow such a reunion. Whether the and you know, that's the bottom line is, I mean, kids especially, or anybody, trust doesn't happen overnight. It happens over time. And when you've been hurt time and time again, or somebody wasn't there, or they didn't listen, you know, you're going to stop engaging. You're going to stop calling. You're going to stop sharing. And just because the person changes doesn't mean we're going to trust you all of a sudden. It just takes time. Like, that's a saying, time takes time. Like, it just takes time. And in God's time, you know, it's not our time. It's in God's time. But we just have to do the best we can, and we have to do it out of love. Whether the family goes on a spiritual basis or not, the alcoholic member has to, if he would recover. The others must be convinced of his new status beyond the shadow of a doubt. Seeing is believing, right? That's that time thing, time after time, seeing it to most families who have lived with a drinker. You can't just say, you know, I have an ex-boyfriend in the program, and he relapsed. And his son, his 17-year-old son, has been calling me for help. And I used to, you know, and the thing is, this son is so hurt that he doesn't want to go home to his house for the holidays. He wants to, like, go to a friend's. His mom moved away, and the dad, he's like, no, I don't trust him. And I said, but he's not drinking anymore. No, but he was. Like, he said he wasn't, and I knew he was. Like, that distrust, you can't go from this trusting, loving, I'll do anything for you, and then lying your face off and acting like a jerk when you're drunk and saying things and bashing your mother and all that crazy crap that people do, and then be sober and be like, I love you, come home, you can tell me anything you want. That just, it doesn't work with Kit. That just doesn't work. Yeah, and it's interesting because this boy, who I spent quite a bit of time with, you know, through all this, I'm still the sober one, right? I'm not his mother, and I'm not his father. And his father separated his children from me for about 6 months and said, you know, please stop contacting us and the kids, you know. And that son called me because he trusted me because I'm sober. And he watched the way I acted. And the way I acted never changed. It was always the same. But his own father, I mean, that's just so sad to me. Like, his father, I don't know if that child, like, how long will it take for this child, after this father's been doing this his whole life, for this child, you know? Like, the guy gets 3 years sober, and he thinks he's the best dad ever, and it's just so painful to watch from the outside, you know, for me. And then, of course, the mother, the ex-wife, uses that as ammunition. And now World War III, you know, I mean, it's really, and the kid is just caught in the middle. And this man had another son from another marriage, and so these boys were half-brothers, and he made a big deal about making, you know, your brother this, your brother that. And they were about 12 years difference, and now they don't see each other. You know, now all of a sudden, there's no communication between these brothers. You know, one's in second grade, and one's in, you know. And that's all because the father friggin' didn't stay sober. And it's those boys and that relationship and the lack of the sibling and, you know, it's such a disaster. Oh, it's really sad. Seeing is believing to most families who've lived with a drinker. There you go. Here is a case in point. One of our friends is a heavy smoker and a coffee drinker. There's no doubt that he overindulged. Seeing this and meaning to be helpful, his wife commenced to admonish him about it. He admitted he was overdoing these things, but frankly said that he was not ready to stop. His wife is one of those persons who really feels there's something rather sinful about these commodities, so she nagged, and her intolerance finally threw him into a fit of anger. He got drunk. Of course, our friend was wrong, dead wrong. He had to painfully admit that and mend his spiritual fences. Though now he is a most effective member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he still smokes and drinks coffee, but neither his wife nor anyone else stands in judgment. She sees she was wrong to make a burning issue out of such a matter when his more serious ailments were being rapidly cured. We have three little mottos which are apropos. Here they are. First things first, let and let live, and easy does it. There you go. Okay, yeah. Thank you.